Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Thanks for downloading the Inside Lacrosse D1 Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Flynn, joined as always by my man, Terry Foy. If you like what you hear, please tell a friend. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. You can leave a rating and a comment there. Or hit us up on Twitter at D_Fly and at Terrence Foy. If you'd like to share a thought, a comment, or a question, email us at dflynn@insidelacrosse.com and tfoy@insidelacrosse.com. We love hearing you, your comments and your questions and your emails. Really appreciate those. It's been a huge couple of weeks on Inside Lacrosse Podcast. We hope you listen to Zach Babo's podcast with D3 Selection Chair Sean Quirk. And make sure to check out Hallie Quillenen's recent podcast with Maryland coach Kathy Reese and Penn State coach Missy Daugherty. On today's show, we'll be discussing news and notes, including some coaching drama. We'll talk about Tewarton finalists, Lacrosse Industry Summit, all the games from the first round, and of course, we'll preview second round games in the quarterfinals. Here we go. Terry, let's get right into the biggest story of the week is whether or not Dom Stargirl will return as the head coach at the University of Virginia. But while I want to get your thoughts on that, we broke the story at Inside Lacrosse that something was going on down there. And I really would like to get your take on how we cover a story like that. What goes on behind the scenes? I know there were a lot of decisions. Do we, you know, checked with a lot of sources? But I'd like to give the listeners sort of a behind the scenes look at what's been going on here the last few days.
Yeah, and it's been interesting. I mean, you know, there are a couple of aspects, a couple of pieces of context that I think are important to understand. The first is that this is not we understand that by and large, you know, this is not the Pentagon Papers or, you know, Watergate. But at the same time, we take this very seriously, this type of development, because it's a man's livelihood. You know, there are only so many stories that come across our plate at Inside Lacrosse that could be, that could have, you know, graver situations and graver things going on. So, you know, in particularly, you know, in Coach Starge's case, it's not just about whether or not, you know, he'll be remaining at Virginia. It's a lot about his legacy and reputation.
Sure, so a beloved coach who's the winningest coach in the history of Division I lacrosse in terms of wins.
Sure, and so again, it's something that we do take seriously. That being said, you know, there's aspects to this that are in exact science, and a lot of the reaction to the reporting that I've read, it just felt like there were some things that I wanted to say to address it. So the first question is, why do we feel compelled at Inside Lacrosse to report on this story at all? And it's funny because there are media professionals that work at Inside Lacrosse, some of whom went and studied journalism in college. But by and large, you know, I don't think that we consider ourselves pure journalists. So if you want to get into a theoretical conversation about the value of news breaking, news gathering, like, it's a little bit more valid here than it is at a lot of your, you know, big local daily newspapers and that sort of thing. That being said, we as an organization bill ourselves as, you know, the bedrock of our editorial operation is news, opinion, and analysis. And that's been, you know, it was on the cover of the magazine for the first 10 years. As a result, being a part of these stories is the fabric of Inside Lacrosse, and I think it's what our readers have come to expect. It was interesting to me in the development of my own career, in the way that I tried to learn on the fly how to navigate these situations, because at the outset of my time at Inside Lacrosse, Christian Sweezy was a full-time employee, and these were very much, you know, his wheelhouse. I remember distinctly the rush of excitement, as well as the steps taken to report on and confirm Bill Tierney leaving Princeton for Denver. Prior to that, you know, I had only kind of dabbled in this type of reporting and this type of news writing. In the wake of that, you know, I've reported on Jeff Tamburoni's leaving Cornell to go to Penn State. That was a very big and fast developing story. I've reported on the establishment of Michigan as a varsity program. I reported on Big Ten lacrosse becoming a reality and Johns Hopkins joining as an affiliate. Those are the three biggest stories in my career that I point to as being really impactful on, you know, my trajectory as somebody who gathers and reports on news. And it's interesting that the Johns Hopkins ones is the most recent, I suppose, because, you know, that's the only one that I point to is we made a mistake. We reported in that story that Johns Hopkins women's team was joining the Big Ten as an affiliate as well. That was incorrect, and that was something that we had to walk back. You know, all of that is the context by which to get to this, to say that, you know, we have our processes and practices for how to try to confirm a story that is developing, particularly for information that is difficult to confirm. And so applying that to the Dom Starja story, obviously heading into the 2016 season, there were questions about whether or not he was going to return. And that's the subtext of the March issue feature on The Verge, written by Christian Sweezy, that was posted on InsideLacrosse.com after their season got off to the start that it did. Certainly, there was an eye toward a quick decision being made, whether by Dom or by the administration, toward the end of their season. So, you know, I think that there was extra attention paid to the Duke game and the Brown game for that reason. And it was clear that, you know, that was not going to occur. That didn't come to pass. And then certainly when the director of athletics, Craig Littlepage, made a comment to the Charlottesville Daily Progress that indicated that Dom's status was under review, you know, created a little bit more earnestness towards trying to find out what was going on. We had conversations with people, and this is the part of my explanation where I want to address what the word sources means, because I think it's become a little bit of a bugaboo in the way that when people are wrong, you typically just, I don't know, you see reporters not infrequently say, well, my sources had it incorrect. And it feels like a way to disperse blame. Sources are people that we know. Like it's an umbrella term that means, you know, any group of other college coaches, alums, parents, friends, you know, just it runs the gamut. It's basically anybody that has information pertinent to what you're trying to report on and is willing to talk to you. And that brings you to the second question, which is, why would anybody ever share this type of information with the press? And I think that the answer to that question is wildly different. Some people are just polite and they want to answer a question when you ask it to them. Other people certainly have a stake and they want to push the conversation forward in whatever way they want to push it forward. It certainly depends on the story and the aspects involved. And then others you trade information with, others you just earn their trust. And the reason that so many sources go unnamed is because their information is valid, but the person providing the information isn't necessarily pertinent to the story itself. And that's why there have been instances when we've rejected, you know, either my own use or McNear's use or a freelance writer's use of an anonymous source, but just by saying there's no reason for this person not to be named. But in this case, you know, in the case of Eves for an opportunity to comment, and both essentially declined, as written in the story. The athletics department spokesperson referred us to the comment that was provided to the Daily Progress. And then it became a function of how certain do we feel. My biggest concern was that the multiple sources of information were essentially the result of an echo chamber effect. So I tried to
explain what you mean there.
That everybody had heard the same thing from itself, meaning that like one person, one reliable person with a piece of information, you know, made a comment, and then the telephone effect occurred where, you know, it went from, the meeting didn't go very well, to he's not being renewed, and then everybody says it to themselves.
Yeah,
meaning
so
that one source is equivalent to 10 different people saying the same thing.
And to give you an idea of what Terry's talking about, our crew was at Johns Hopkins on Monday night for the MIAA conference semifinals, the A-conference semifinals, of like the best Maryland high school teams, private schools playing. And it was definitely going around. You know, I heard from multiple sources. I was working and on the field most of the time and still heard from multiple people saying, hey, what'd you hear about this? Did you know this was happening? And even some of this, we've talked about this, Terry and I have talked about this privately, but some of the sources seemed
Like they shouldn't have known.
Yeah, exactly.
Far enough away from the epicenter of the information that it was head-scratching that they would know.
Correct.
But again, in a community as small as ours, in a community where there's so much interest and a particular storyline for which there's so much interest, it's not surprising that this level of conversation would occur. Anyhow, fast forward, obviously the fact that the athletics department did not provide a comment on Tuesday after the initial report, which was then independently confirmed by multiple news agencies. Lacrosse Magazine said that they had confirmed the report. Lex Sports Network said that they had confirmed the report. Eventually, I believe the Washington Post said that they had confirmed the report. And then there were a lot of folks pointing back to our initial report as well. There was some consternation over the fact that there had not been official comment provided. Obviously, that stretched into Wednesday. We're recording this on Thursday morning. And over the course of the day, Wednesday, I had multiple people with whom I had had the initial conversations with on Tuesday to feel comfortable enough with confirmation come back to me and say, the situation is not the same as it was on Tuesday. There were more meetings Wednesday. The reason that Inside Lacrosse, as of Thursday morning, has not posted anything that reflects a change in the tenor of the conversation is because we don't know what the situation is. So it's, I will say at this point, possible that Dom Sarge will return as the coach in 2017, which would essentially mean that the story that we posted on Tuesday was wrong. If that is the case, it'll be probably the most embarrassing instance of this type of news gathering and reporting I have ever experienced in my 8 years at Inside Lacrosse. That being said, I also think that there will have been an element of the fact that the story changed, and that may be very difficult to confirm and report. Maybe it won't, and that's where we're at. That's what we got to wait and see.
How many different people would you estimate that you've talked to about this?
25.
Yeah, and you've shared some of that stuff with me from very credible sources who would be in the know. So, if we, you know, nothing that we have said so far is inaccurate, but the story could change, and we will certainly report it as the news changes.
Yeah, and you know, and we'll
see. Simplest way to put it, right?
I do take some consolation in terms of that embarrassment and knowing that not only, you know, the other media agencies that reported something similar to what we did, you know, that helps to a degree, but not that doesn't go a long way. What goes a long way is the people, particularly the college coaches that I speak to, will be as flabbergasted by this result if he is back, based on what the quiet conversations were.
Now, we know he has an unusual contract situation. Most contracts would end for coaching. It usually runs with the school year. You know, kind of ends in June 30th, something like June 1st. His ends in January 2017, his current contract. So he has an interesting contract situation that is, you know, slightly unusual. So if the news changes, we have not heard anything specific whether he will be back or not. But we also haven't heard what, if he is coming back, what those details will be.
Oh, absolutely not.
Okay.
Yeah, and I mean, at this point, it just feels, you know, Dom Sarge has been a tremendous supporter of Inside Lacrosse. He's been a tremendous supporter of lacrosse media. You know, he's always been very nice, polite, and cordial to me. It just feels weird to have talked about it for 15 yeah. minutes at this point.
I know.
When really what we're saying is we may have made a mistake. We don't really know. We feel like we didn't but it feels like we're never going to be able to explain that we didn't. And maybe we will. Maybe it'll turn out that we didn't. You know what I mean? It's just so confusing. And I was asked last night whether this is the most interesting story I've been a part of in terms of like that journalistic point of view. And, you know, all of them kind of have their own unique elements to them. But at this point, yeah, I would say that this has been the most interesting exercise in this that I've ever been a part of. And the one thing that is like kind of jumping to mind right now is that I'm sure that there are journalism professors all over the country listening to this and being like, oh, well, you just did it completely wrong. And if that's the case, so be it.
This reminds me of another coaching situation that is so when I was working at the University of Pennsylvania, the legendary Penn coach, Fran Dunphy, was up for like a contract renewal. He's now the coach at Temple and has been there since probably 2006, the 2006-07 season, and has had great success there, but won a lot of Ivy League championships, went to the NCAA tournament with some of Penn's best teams. So when John Chaney retired at Temple, Fran was offered the job. And he didn't necessarily want to leave Penn, but he wasn't also really welcome to stay at the same time by the former athletic director. So there was sort of like a stalemate there. And it kind of went for weeks, as I remember it, with no sort of answer of whether he was going to take the Temple job or stay at Penn. And in the Philadelphia area, the Big Five basketball, that's a major deal. And even on the national stage, I mean, Temple's and Penn are sort of national programs. And it kind of reminds me of that, like, there's just been no news out of Charlottesville one way or the other. You know, there's a lot of rumors or sources confirming, not so many denying the story. And it sort of harkens me back to those days in Philly when a major coach was sort of in limbo, and then he ended up just going to Temple.
Yeah, well, and he had been the coach of Michael Jordan, not the Michael Jordan, the other Michael Jordan, who was like an awesome Penn basketball player that led them to the NCAA tournament, right?
Yeah, and Jerome Allen and Matt Maloney. Matt Maloney played on the Rockets. He was the starting point guard on the championship Rockets teams in the early 90s. I mean, he coached some great
players.
Wasn't
Sam Cassell the starting point guard on the championship Rockets teams in the early
90s? Two guard.
Okay.
I mean, they had the Dream, and that's...
Otis Thorpe, Vernon Maxwell. I love those
teams.
Yeah,
you remember that too. But something similar to it that I can relate to a little bit.
Yeah, well, and I think that, you know, again, I think it's time to move on. There's not a lot more that we can say right now. I will say that I've received three text messages saying just outlandish stuff since this. I mean, there are coaches speculating about who's going to take over.
You got one when we started recording that you showed me that is, I can't believe it. I can't believe that someone would say that, text you that about what could happen now.
Yeah.
It's good stuff, man. Sarah, let's move on. Some other good stuff that took a big twist over the weekend. The Twarton finalists were announced. Five guys were announced as the finalists for lacrosse's biggest award to college players. Connor Canizero, Denver attackman. Miles Jones from Duke. Matt Landis, a defenseman from Notre Dame. Dylan Malloy from Brown. And Ben Reeves from Yale. Three of those guys got knocked out of the NCAA tournament on Saturday, leaving Matt Landis, a defenseman, has never won the Twarton, and Dylan Malloy, sort of the front runner prior to last weekend. And now it seems almost with Brown moving on to the quarters and hosting this weekend with a fairly good chance to get to the NCAA semifinals, like it's Dylan Malloy's award to lose.
Yeah, so first of all, I mean, this would be our broadcast observation of the week had it not been for another one that we will get to when we get to our broadcast observation of the week. But to your point about the three of the players having been knocked out in the first round, they announced the five finalists at halftime of the Albany-Syracuse game, whereas previously they had announced it on Thursday or Friday of the week prior, leading up to the first round. So, you know, at that point they knew. I believe there's one instance. I can recall one instance of a player being named a finalist who did not make the NCAA tournament.
Do you remember who that was?
It was the Army attackman, not Garrett Thule. It was his predecessor. Went on to, I'll look it up.
John?
Not John Glessner either.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was more recent. We'll
talk about the Duke Loyola game, but Duke was favored in that game.
Yeah.
So three favorites sort of got upset.
Right.
You know, Denver, Yale, and Duke. Kind of leading to this too. So I think ESPN was waiting for, you know, a really cool announcement in sort of their marquee Sunday night game halftime, and we're probably a little disappointed when three of those guys were done for the year.
Yeah. Getting to the actual race as it stands right now, I think that Dylan Malloy should be a tremendously heavy favorite, and I certainly will not dispute that. I do think that if Brown loses this week, particularly if Dylan does not play well, and by that I mean put up significant number of points, and Notre Dame wins the national championship, I do think Matt Landis will win. If Dylan Malloy advances to the Final Four, I think there is no circumstance under which he will lose the award.
What if Notre Dame and Denver and Brown meet in the championship game and Landis shuts him down?
That's a great scenario. I didn't even consider that. I mean, that would actually be one
of those. Could happen. They're on opposite sides of the bracket and they could meet in the championship game.
Oh man. I feel like Landis would win in that scenario, right?
I don't know. I'm looking at Dylan Mullins.
His numbers are
they're insane. He leads the nation in goals and assists and has 114 points.
Yeah, but Stony Brook Attack and Mike Rooney had 111 points last season, and he wasn't even a finalist.
Yeah, I see that. And you know who isn't a finalist either is the man who's number two, Pat Spencer, with his 78 points, and Dylan's teammate, Kyler Balestri, who has 84 points. That's a formidable Brown attack.
Yeah, there's no question about that. I think that, you know, Brown is just so tough. I wrote about this in the last Player of the Year watch. I mean, you can make an argument that they have the best goalie, the best long stick middie, maybe the two best attackmen, if not two of the five best attackmen. And then if Alec Tullett is not the best defensive player, you know, he's probably in the top two or three behind Landis and maybe, I don't know. I mean, it was Matt Dunn, but obviously his injury situation has prevented him from playing the beginning of the season and drawing the top matchup in every game. So I don't know, man. It's going to be an interesting race, or it's not. You know, I think that it's possible, particularly if Notre Dame loses and Dylan Malloy puts up 8 points this week, it's
over.
A deal.
Yeah, in any case, all eyes will be on Dylan Malloy this week, and hopefully if Brown advances in next week as well. Terry, one other news and note, the Lacrosse Industry Summit is scheduled for next Friday, May 27th in Philadelphia. It's coming together very well. Some additional sessions were announced in addition to the two keynote panels. And again, the Industry Summit is open to all professionals in the lacrosse business. It will be a gathering of the industry's most influential people to share insights and spark discussions that will help shape the future of the sport. It takes place at the Lowe's Philadelphia Hotel in downtown Philly. And if you work in the sport of lacrosse, you should be there. For more information, go to insidelacrosse.com/summit.
Yeah, so I'm really excited about the panels that we added, a technology panel, sponsorship activation, and kind of maximizing revenue from your property, be it an event or a media entity or anything like that. Paul Rabel is going to speak with Rick Allen, who has a close connection with the lacrosse world. His son played at Duke. And obviously, you know, Paul has an entrepreneurial eye that is pretty uncommon, whether, you know, in any walk of life, but certainly in the world of professional athletes and lacrosse. So I think that that's going to be an interesting conversation between a well-seasoned corporate professional with an amazing experience record. And then another conversation that I'm really looking forward to listening to is about the Harlem Lacrosse and Leadership Spotlight through the Dick's Sporting Goods Sports Matter campaign. Joel Sensor will represent Harlem Lacrosse, and a rep from brand marketing at Dick's will talk about how that campaign came together and why there is some belief that it was so successful. I would contend it is the best mainstream representation of the sport that I've ever seen. You know, all throughout the college football season last year, you know, just adds spotlighting how important Harlem Lacrosse is to its members and its participants. I mean, it was just a really motivating and really substantial thing. So I think that the industry summit's come together, like you said, very nicely. I'm really excited for the day, and I would encourage anybody who's on the fence about it to get your tickets, because we are getting close to max capacity. So we're looking forward to bringing together a lot of thought leaders and pushing the conversation about where our sport is and where it could go and where it should go. We're looking forward to pushing that conversation forward.
Terry, complete side note, but speaking of lacrosse and entrepreneurs, I want to give a shout out to Rachel Zeitz, who owner and founder of Gladiator Lacrosse, who was on ABC Shark Tank last week.
Yep.
15-year-old girl, goes to Pinecrest in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and just an impressive young lady. I encourage you to check out. I won't spoiler alert you, but she's on latest Shark Tank episode and was very impressed by her and what she's trying to accomplish.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to have to make sure that she's on the panel for Lacrosse Industry Summit Session 2.
Yeah, next year. Terry, moving on.
Dan,
a lot of stuff has happened. In our personal sporting lives.
So like I said earlier, we're recording this on a Thursday morning. We typically record on Monday afternoon. That wasn't going to be possible because of the aforementioned MIAA semifinals. And then, as I tweeted on Tuesday night, the development of breaking news that we needed to cover, as well as the time spent on that, which, you know, we discussed for 15 minutes to start this podcast and don't need to belabor, made it so that we weren't able to record on Tuesday, and then similarly pretty much on Wednesday. Here we are Thursday morning, and I think that there are some people that will say that we delayed this because Arsenal finished ahead of Spurs in the Premier League.
Some people will. I think that's why we're just talking now and you haven't been able to recover. Terry, so Newcastle, already relegated, down, nothing to play for, down to 10 men, five goals on Tottenham.
Okay, so I actually,
what happened?
I can spin zone this really easy. Well, the first thing that happened is that Christian Eriksen got called for a penalty that was clearly not a penalty, and they scored. And that put Newcastle up 3-1 after Spurs had scored to turn a 2-0 halftime deficit into a 2-1 deficit with about 20 to 22 minutes left to play. You mentioned that Newcastle was down to 10 men. The field was tilted in Spurs' favor. This was a game that Tottenham very easily could win and has won over the course of the first 34 games of this season. Once that penalty went in, which is just so maddening because the ball is not supposed to lie. Like this was a ball don't lie situation like you read about, and there is no question that Hugo Lloris should have made that save just to write the karmic element. Christian Eriksen didn't even touch the Newcastle attacking player that went down. It was so frustrating, and I think that the players felt that afterwards, and it just manifested itself in two goals that didn't matter. You know, I think at that point they probably knew that Arsenal had put away Villa, and you know, unless they were going to score three goals, it wasn't going to make much of a difference.
I think Raj Bennett from NBC said it best: "So Spursy."
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about it is that it's not even really about. To me, it's not really even about – this is a different element of Spursiness that's very localized to the 2015-16 season. And the thing that's so frustrating about, you know, in games 34 to 37, losing 7 points from winning possessions and then really collapsing down the stretch, is that this is a Spurs team that through the first 33 games of the season made its bones on mental toughness and incredible fitness. And – you know, in the West Ham result and the Chelsea result, you could certainly point to and say, or West Brom and Chelsea, you could say, you know, it was whether it was their fitness that then fatigue that let them down first, and then ultimately the Dele Alli and Moussa Dembele suspensions were a result of the lack of mental toughness. It's just so anathema to the team that Mauricio Pochettino had built through the first 6 months of the season. The only silver lining I can derive is that, and he said this going into the final game, they can't be content with themselves. They need to, as a team, focus on what they didn't do that caused them to come up short. There's no tangible negative result to finishing third versus finishing second. They are still in the Champions League. It is still far beyond the expectations that were set at the beginning of the season. And as a result, there's a lot to be pleased about. That being said, obviously it's disappointing, and I wonder if that disappointment is better for the 2016-17 follow-up, which was already going to be very difficult in terms of ensuring that the team's organizational focus on improvement is maintained as opposed to sitting pat. And I think that each individual player, particularly those who did not meet the standard down the stretch that they had set earlier in the season, invest in that. But, Dan, that was not the only source of consternation. As if the gods knew that I was going to be spending 17 hours on the couch watching lacrosse, they decided that they needed to give me another 90 minutes at 9 p.m. on Sunday night because they aired Believe Land, which is a chronicle, an anthology of Cleveland horrible sports moments. I actually wasn't able to watch it in one sitting. I had to turn it off and come back.
How'd they cut it down to 90 minutes? required a lot of editing.
You know that there's
they must have left out a lot.
O.J. Simpson 6-hour documentary coming up. It really felt like it could have been that long. I mean, it was, you know, there were definitely aspects. I will say, though, that, like, unless you get into, like, the absolute downtroddenness of some of the teams over the course of specific amounts of time, like, there aren't that many instances of tragedy. You know, really, like, they focused on three Browns games in the 80s.
Remember when Baltimore took your team and then won two Super Bowls? And then you drafted Tim Couch number one overall?
Yeah.
Remember the Butch Davis era?
Well, right. So, like, the Butch Davis era doesn't even bear mention.
Right, yeah.
I mean, the only thing that happened was you lose to the Steelers twice, you make it to the first round of the playoffs, you lose to the Steelers a third time, and you believe that Kelly Holcomb is your starting quarterback heading into the next year.
I think he played for the Ravens, too, didn't he?
I don't know. Well, my favorite thing, and this is something that the Browns managed to do, Lee Suggs is the absolute best manifestation of this. It was right around the 2001-2003 window. Lee Suggs and Willie Green from Boston College were supposed to be the future running back. Lee Suggs had a good career at Virginia Tech, and I think he rushed for like 140 yards in week 17. And it's as if Browns fans don't understand that opponents don't care in week 17, and this happens every year. There's like just an incredible performance, and oh, it's so horrible. All of a sudden, heading into the next season, we got our running back, we got our quarterback. It's absurd.
Yeah.
And But I mean, you know, the Craig Elo falling down behind Michael Jordan, you know, that's an iconic shot. But those teams were just unfortunate to be, you know, a very good team, but the second best team in the East when the Bulls were coming to prominence. And then obviously, like, the, you know, the 07, no, just in terms of going like team by team, like the Indians only have two. Just, you know, the 97 collapse against the Marlins is really the only thing
that
is worth kind of pointing out. Even, you know, the 03 World Series or 07 World Series or ALCS against the Red Sox when they collapsed, that doesn't really like resonate in memory. You know, so moving on.
That was for all of our listeners in northeastern Ohio.
It was.
But there is some good stuff going on right now in Cleveland. With this Cavs team.
Yeah, we benefited from
Kyrie.
Yeah.
And LeBron are looking formidable.
Are you going to cheer when the Cavs advance to the NBA Finals and whether they play the Warriors or the Thunder, are you going to cheer for the Cavs because Kyrie is a Duke guy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I like watching the Cavs, and Cleveland needs this more than the Bay Area needs another championship or any other something. I mean, it's the most beautiful place in the United States, possibly. They don't need any.
Central Oklahoma could probably stay.
They don't need any extra love if Golden State gets to the finals again. But I have a couple friends who can't stand LeBron. They think he's the worst person on the planet. And I don't understand the venom that they have since they've, you know, never met him or, you know, he's never really run afoul of the law, or there's a lot of other sports figures that I could see you maybe not liking as much. But the fact that they particularly hate LeBron so much is comical. So I root for him just to make my buddies angry. So Terry, let's move on to something a lot more exciting. The games. What a first weekend of NCAA tournament games.
It was awesome. I mean, you know, there were a lot of conversations about whether or not this was the best weekend of college lacrosse, first round NCAA tournament. I mean, I think that what we lacked in dramatic finishes, you know, really the Marquette Carolina finish stands out as being the most dramatic. Even the Albany Syracuse game, it felt like Albany was going to be able to make a late push to get that back to even, and they weren't. You know, it was really the upsets that were so exciting. You know, and obviously, I think you got to start with Denver Towson. The Towson Tigers coming off of a midweek game. They beat Hobart in a NCAA tournament preliminary round game, which I felt like they did not deserve to be in. I thought that Air Force should have been in that. They then handled the quick turnaround, head out to Denver, the Mile High City, and take on the defending champions in Peter Barton Stadium, come away 10-9 victors. Denver, with a late run, scored two goals late.
This is a classic Bill Simmons type, nobody believed in us game. And Towson has that going. You know, I'm sure Coach Nadelin gave them the 45 guys in this locker room believe we can win this game speech probably before and during and after the game. But whatever he is saying to his Towson Tigers, they are believing in him and playing their best lacrosse of the year.
It was interesting because this was a matchup of like styles in the sense that long possessions, physical defense. I don't recall exactly what my feeling was heading into it. I think I felt like it was going to be a close game. I didn't think that Towson was going to win, but I felt like it was going to be a close game. But in retrospect, it's not as surprising, to me at least, as Navy beating Yale, even though that's also a like matchup stylistically. The thing about this that makes sense is Towson is so tough physically that you can imagine them knocking any offense, including the second highest scoring offense and arguably the most efficient offense, off of its game. But it really did feel like Denver was out of sync. It's just very difficult as an outsider to know how much that was a function of Towson's defense versus just Denver's offense not having a good day.
So Terry, the day started with Loyola beating Duke 16-11 in a really fun game to watch. Your Greyhounds looked very good offensively, and Duke's recent outstanding defensive play sort of fell apart against Loyola.
Yeah, and it was quite a reversal from the first time that these two teams played. You know, to me, I thought the biggest difference in this game was how frequently Loyola was able to cause turnovers. I believe they caused 13 in the first half, and I want to say that at least four of them were caused by trail checks. It was interesting. I was talking to another Division I head coach about this game, and he wondered whether or not it was a part of Loyola's game plan. Were they able to identify that Duke hung their sticks when they were dodging? It was interesting, particularly to me, how effective Loyola was in sending Miles Jones to his left hand. That Division I coach actually posited, well, he's going to beat our pole anyway. Why don't we just let him beat him, draw the slide, and maybe we can get a trail check and see what happens. That ended up being what worked. I think that the Loyola game plan, the tenet of it, was to press out more, not allow Miles to begin his dodge at 15 yards with a little bit of a shake, a little bit of a shoulder push, but instead force him to use his speed to create separation. And Ryan Fournier caught him twice from the backside. I just thought it was excellent in the way that Loyola was able to overcome a face-off deficiency by virtue of causing these turnovers, particularly in the first half. And then to your point about how good Loyola looked, you know, it's not that surprising. It was Duke's second slides off-ball defense that were maligned all year. And really, you know, for all the attention that Pat Spencer has gotten, and he deserves all of it because he's awesome, you know, Zach Harawires has been a big recipient of this in terms of the way that their chemistry seems to have developed over the course of the late season and how much Spencer has found Harawires to feed easy finishes, you know, and I thought that the Duke game was a good example of that.
Yeah, we saw Pat Spencer in person on Monday night over at the MIAs. He's a big kid.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, he's drawn comparisons to Connor Gill, which, you know,
he's much
that
bigger,
was kind of my
like broader, like a more physical guy. Connor's tall, but lanky.
Yeah.
Pat seemed, his height and weight are?
Yeah.
He's got to be
6'3". Like 6'2", maybe.
Okay.
Probably like 195 pounds, 190 pounds, somewhere in that range.
Yeah, he looked bigger than that in person.
Well, that was why I speculated that he could play midfield to start the year if they needed him to, if they felt comfortable with Zach Sirico being the trigger man at attack. You know, because he is, I think, you know, one of the terms that was used so frequently to describe his style since that Duke game was heads up, eyes up. He's just always got his eyes up. He's looking to feed. And I think that's a really valuable asset for a dodging midfielder as well. We have seen him, I don't know what the term for an attackman exverting to up top, playing the point, but we've seen him do that a little bit as well in settled 6-on-6 situations. So, you know, his skill set is just so varied. He has been definitely the revelation of the season so far, and, you know, best freshman and certainly a building block for Loyola going forward.
He's listed at 6'2", 190 on Loyola's roster, which surprised me. He just looks like he's filled out a little bit more than that. He had 8 points, 3 goals, 5 assists. Harawires had 6 goals. But for Duke, Jack Bruckner, 6 goals.
That was amazing.
Yeah, nice day for him.
All in the first half, I believe.
Terry, moving on. The next game, it was really cool to watch an NCAA tournament game in Wisconsin. It's North Carolina eked out a 10-9 win over first-time NCAA team Marquette.
Yeah, so my read on this game is that despite the fact that North Carolina came in as a heavy favorite, it would have felt, and maybe heavy is too strong of a word, two-goal favorite, it would have felt like in order for for Marquette to pull off an upset, North Carolina would have had to play not its best game. Maybe they didn't play their best game, but I thought they played pretty well. And I thought that it started from their first midfield, and I think that when North Carolina's first midfield plays well, you can expect their team to play well in total, particularly because you would expect it to, you know, it just feels like Luke Goldstock and Steve Pontrello, like those guys are known quantities compared to, you know, some of, in terms of they'd had success prior to this year in comparison to some of those first midfielders. I thought Michael Tagliaferri played really well. I thought Patrick Kelly played really well. And as a result, the fact that Marquette was able to keep it to a goal, and really, in my opinion, they got the look that they wanted to tie it late. And even though the shot went wide, I believe it was a Blaine Fleming shot, you know, it was a step-down look from up top off of a rollback and a throwback, essentially. They should have gotten another look with about 25 seconds left. Unfortunately, maybe it was closer to 15 seconds. Unfortunately, the shot hit the attackman that was backing it up at X, and North Carolina was able to grab the ground ball. It was a great, you know, really nice play by the Carolina defense, but one of those unfortunate circumstances that you don't expect when you're drawing up the play in the timeout before the final sequence. You know, so had they had another opportunity, would they have been able to generate a similar type of look and actually can it the second time, send the game to overtime, and then who knows? I mean, I think that that's a reasonable way to look at it. So ultimately, Carolina played pretty well. I think it validates Marquette as a good team, and I think that, you know, it was a justifiable outcome. But at the same time, if I were Marquette, I would not hang my head about this result. It felt like, you know, if not a coin flip game, pretty close to one.
So Carolina will move on to the quarterfinals for their first Final Four attempt, or attempting to get to the Final Four for the first time in two decades. But Marquette wraps up a wonderful fourth season for the program, and really the program has been, the bar has been set pretty high for Marquette.
Yeah, and you mentioned the nature of playing a game in Wisconsin. It brings us to our broadcast observation of the week. They brought cheese onto the set in Charlotte, North Carolina, where Anish Shroff, Quinn Kesnick, and my man, High Point head coach John Torpy, were analyzing the games all throughout the weekend. It was an amazing marathon. And, yeah, I believe they called it Gruyere, Wisconsin Gruyere. I'm a little skeptical. I think it just looked like a cheese plate of chopped white and chopped yellow sharp cheddar. That being said, the funniest, there were two funny moments of the weekend. I mean, this was a little, I've interviewed John Torpy before.
Yeah, you love that guy.
He's the man, but he's not very comfortable on camera. But I think every coach understands that if you get extended this opportunity, you can't turn it down.
Yeah.
It's too important for the prospects of your program. And I thought he did a really nice job. When he was offered the cheese, it was like in Seinfeld when Jerry sees Poppy in the bathroom. He doesn't wash his hands.
Yeah, Poppy was sloppy.
No, have the pizza. Jerry, take a bite of the pizza. And then George does the same thing later in the episode. Tor was just like, just shake his head. No, not going to eat on camera. It was so funny. And then on Sunday, and I don't know if this was a late development, but they did a half-hour preview show. And at the end of the sequence, right before the Maryland-Connecticut game started, for the last like 3 or 4 minutes, something happened and Torf had a coughing fit and he could not stop. It was, oh man, I felt so bad for him. And it was clear that because he was, you know, relatively unfamiliar, he didn't know how to cut his mic. So it was like, Quint would make the point. It would be like, you know, in a solo shot, he'd be making his point. And then you'd hear this cough from off camera. And it was just like, Quint would smile and he'd be like, this is just so unfortunate.
I had family obligations all weekend, so I was watching the games and the coverage, but often with the, you know, the volume down a little bit with you know, conversations and stuff, visiting with people. And John Torby did not look that comfortable on camera. There's no doubt about that.
Well, that was our broadcast observation of the week. So let's move on to the...
My Blue Jays went up to Providence, you know, undermanned Jays team, gave it a good fight, but Brown just killed him. It was final score of 17-8. It was 6-2 at halftime, and then Brown finished them off basically in the third quarter, outscoring the Jays 8-1 in the third. And a disappointing season for Hopkins. As a Hopkins fan, you know, some people have been trying to give me some grief this week, but I just feel like I'm kind of glad the season's over. It was just one of those kind of years, like fought hard, but just didn't have the talent level to really get that far. and sort of a fitting end to our season.
The thing that impressed me most about this game is just how physical and how good and how athletic Brown's defense is. Certainly Larkin Kemp and Alec Tullett had gotten a lot of attention over the course of the year. But JJ and Cyclo, a guy who we know because he worked the Inside Lacrosse Northeast Recruiting Invitational at Brown in November, really good dude. He is awesome, man. He's just, you know, one of those prototypical defenders, just the right height because he's not too tall. He's able to sit down in the stance, turn guys away, big shoulders, strong upper body. I was just really impressed by him. And ultimately, it was reminiscent of Loyola in 2012 insofar as watching the semifinal and final against Notre Dame and Maryland, there were moments in each game where Loyola was in control, and it just felt like they're going to win this game because they're better and more athletic. And I can understand at the time it was a revelation. It was like, this shouldn't be. This is a small school that if they win, it should be flukier than this. And I feel like I'm going to have the same revelation with Brown. It's just, it's a very weird situation.
It's a school that has had a lot of success athletically. It's a great academic school, Ivy League school, of course, but not a lot of championships won in any sport, and probably not even a lot of, you know, in the bigger sports, football, basketball, lacrosse, probably haven't won a lot of NCAA tournament games, yeah. You know, so to speak, but some Ivy League championships, but you know, I was talking to one of the all-time greats who was on that 2012 Loyola team last week, Scott Ratliff. I was talking to him on the phone, and we came up about the tournament stuff, and he compared, you know, his team that won the championship to Brown, and said that he sees a lot of similarities between the styles, the players, and sort of position-wise, like who their personnel is.
And it's really fascinating. I think that, you know, now, and we'll get to this weekend's games, you know, they have a Navy team that they're going to be heavy favorites against. So then you're in the Final Four, and it's only two games in one weekend. And we've talked about it over the course of the season, and, you know, is depth an issue? After watching that Hopkins game, it doesn't feel like it. There were guys coming in, making plays late in the game that had not seen the field in a game that I had seen earlier in the season. And not only that, they've blown out enough of those teams that they've gotten a healthy amount of experience as well. So if you're a Brown fan, if you're on the Brown bandwagon, Kyle Devitt, Patrick McEwen, you got to feel pretty good about where you're sitting right now.
Yeah. The last game of Saturday, Terry, or the game we haven't spoken about, is Notre Dame defeated Air Force 15-7. I don't think a lot of people were surprised by that score. It seemed about the way it was going to go, and Notre Dame will move on.
And I think that the biggest storyline, obviously, Notre Dame putting up 15 goals in a game is significant. They just shot really well, and they got good shots. And I thought that, you know, it was impressive to me. Timmy Phillips got the first goal. There were, you know, this is a team that has been maybe not criticized, but the comment has been that Notre Dame's, you know, the limit on their success is that they really rely on four goal scorers.
And they still did. I mean, Mikey Wynn had five goals. Ryder Garnsey had three, and no one else had more than one. So it's, you know, they did get some other people involved, but still, you know, a couple of attackmen, or their attack and Perkovic still were the ones who.
I thought it was Brennan Collins four assists that were really the biggest difference maker in this game because, you know, he's been the third middie on that first line for much of the season, has had a few nicks. But if they get that type of playmaking, you know, it really rounds out their total scoring punch. In addition to, like I said, you know, a short stick like Timmy Phillips, who has come on as the season has progressed, getting to that type of goal scoring level. You mentioned Mikey Wynn. He was so dynamic. I thought that Ryder Garnsey, his shot in the third quarter when he took a knee, maybe it was in the second quarter, and let go of a left-handed rip was just awesome. I mean, it felt like a symbol of the way that Notre Dame was playing, where it felt like it really all came together against Air Force.
Terry, Sunday kicked off the games with the Terps defeating Quinnipiac, who had gotten by Hartford in the play-in game. Terps win that one 13-6.
Yeah, this was a game that was pretty difficult to take too much away from. One of the things that I was thinking about, Quinnipiac scored first, and I was thinking about just the recipe for a upset. We talked about it in previous weeks, how there are kind of three phases of the game that you have to win as an underdog in order to pull off an upset. You know, and oftentimes it's about, you know, staying even enough early and then not getting outrun in that mid-third quarter point when the favorite's depth really starts to emerge, and then about making plays late. By getting the first goal, I was curious about whether or not, you know, how that impacted Quinnipiac's mindset. Did it convince them that they could play with Maryland, or did it, can you know, give them a little bit too much confidence? And I think ultimately, like, to do any type of psychoanalysis would be fruitless because, you know, this was just a Terp team that was came to play and was better than Quinnipiac. That being said, shout out to Foster Como, shout out to Jack Brust. I mean, those are two really, really high-end players that, you know, helped the Bobcats to a unforgettable season.
Matt Rambo, Brian Cole, Henry West, each with a hat trick for the Terps, and they will move on to the quarterfinals. Terry, the biggest game of the day, we touched on it a little bit. Towson upsets Denver 10-9 at Peter Barton Stadium. Surprising win for them. Towson had beat Hobart 18-5 in the midweek to catch the win and advance. Spencer Parks, 4 goals and 2 assists for Towson. But Tyler White was spectacular at times in goal and finished with 13 saves.
Yeah, and it was his performance down the stretch that I think helped build belief on the Tiger sideline that they were going to be able to hold on to the win. Certainly there was a tremendous amount of defensive pressure in the last 6 to 8 minutes of this game. He had a couple of leg saves, caught a couple of saves cleanly. I thought that, you know, Towson didn't look super comfortable in the clearing game in some instances, and I think that'll be interesting against Loyola. You know, but ultimately, you know, there was, oh man, there were just plays all over the field. Pat Conroy, long stick midi, who took the last face off, you know, did just enough to tie up the ball to ensure that there wasn't a clean look to end the game. I was just so impressed by Towson. And like you said, I mean, it definitely, it started with Tyler White and built outward.
Yeah. And I mentioned this guy a long time ago, but Jack Adams, a short stick midfielder, just fantastic defense all game long. Tigers look really sharp.
Yeah.
Really sharp. I do agree that they seem to be running out of gas at the end. If that game could have gone to overtime, it may have gone Denver's way, but you got to give the Tigers a lot of credit. They played extremely well. Terry, another upset happened right after that, you know, on Sunday at Yale. Yale had a fantastic season. It was hosting a Navy team that has really struggled offensively at times. Navy posts 13 goals and beats Yale 13-10.
Yeah, I mean, the 13 goals is just so surprising, obviously, both in terms of Navy's offensive output as well as Yale's defensive output. Senior defenseman Michael Quinn, who was, you know, in that Matt Landis Schmeisser Award, maybe even a Towerton Award type conversation at the beginning of the season, comes out with a knee brace on after an apparent ACL tear against Albany at the end of April and starts. He left in the middle of the contest with a, you know, just another knock to that knee. The thing that impressed me the most about this game was the fact that Navy was able to dig out of a 4-1 deficit. You know, we talked about the stages of an upset, and I felt like they didn't handle that early going very well. And, you know, maybe if Yale had been able to push it to 5-1, that would have been enough. I mean, we did a study about NCAA tournament games and comebacks in 2012, and there is a substantial difference between a 3-goal and a 4-goal lead in terms of the trailing team's ability to come back or the frequency with which that trailing team comes back from that deficit. And I was really impressed by Jack Ray. I thought he was super consistent in terms of his ability to get to his right hand in the middle of the field. I thought Matt Reese was he looked so fast. Casey Reese looked so fast dodging down the alley. John Connors had one of the best games that I've seen him play all season in net for Navy. You know, all around, just a really impressive performance. And, you know, it feels like there's a little bit of momentum building for Navy. I don't expect them to beat Brown, but it will, you know, I would be surprised if they didn't come out firing in the quarterfinal on Saturday.
Last game of the weekend, Syracuse beats Albany 11-9, but Albany had ran out to a 6-2 fast lead early in the game. Cuse comes all the way back to pick up the W.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the stat that jumps off the page on this one is that the faceoffs were 50-50. Zach Ornstein did a tremendous job for Albany, particularly early. But, you know, to hear Matt Kinnear explain it, There was something about the adjustment that the Syracuse coaching staff made at halftime and into the second half that just gave the Orange an edge down the stretch. There were points in the third and fourth quarter where it looked like Albany was going to be able to hold on, but ultimately I think one of the biggest differences, and this is a little bit surprising given the way that their seasons had gone, given the way that their careers had gone, but Syracuse went to redshirt junior goalie Evan Malloy mid-year. He replaced Warren Hill. Warren Hill at that point had a season save percentage in roughly 43%. Since starting, Malloy's save percentage is at about 57.5%, and that was exactly where he was against Albany. I believe he made 12 saves and let in 9 goals. You know, whereas Blaise Reardon made 9 saves and let in 11 goals. So he was sub 50%. You know, it was just a really nice game out of Evan Malloy. I thought he stole a few and helped decide the outcome for the Orange.
So all the quarterfinal games are set. Here are matchups. We'll get into some talk about these games as well as our predictions. Saturday's games are at Brown, Syracuse, and Maryland at noon, a high noon showdown on ESPNU, followed by Navy and Brown approximately 2:30. And then Sunday in the Horseshoe in Columbus, Ohio, North Carolina plays Notre Dame at noon, followed by Towson and Loyola at 2:30. Those games are on So the Notre Dame North Carolina game at noon is on ESPN2. The other game will be on ESPNU. Terry, let's start with Syracuse and Maryland. You know, a lot of people, when the brackets first came out, thought Syracuse was a little underseeded, and it was setting up either an Albany Syracuse matchup for the Terps. Not exactly a favor by the committee. This is going to be a great game. Two classic historic programs playing for Final Four berth.
Yeah, so just looking at the quarterfinals in total, I expect two similar games in two types of ways. So I think that the Syracuse Maryland and Loyola Towson games will be very close. I think that the Notre Dame North Carolina and Brown Navy games are going to have 5 or 6 goal margins. Syracuse Maryland is the one that I feel least confident about the winner of. I think Loyola will beat Towson by a goal or two. This one is 51% either way. I'm going to shade toward Maryland just because they're the higher-seeded team, because they have a little bit more of the recent success in the NCAA tournament. But, you know, Syracuse is just so much of an unknown. They've won games in multiple different types of ways over the course of the season, you know, being dominant on faceoffs. They really haven't had that offensive explosion yet. And they've lost games in considerably different ways as well. I mean, you just look at the Hopkins game, the Notre Dame game, and I guess the recent one that is actually really difficult to put a finger on, Syracuse's win over Duke. I'm not fully certain how to put that into context because we weren't able to see that explosive fourth quarter except for via Periscope. But I was on the road, so I wasn't able to check that one out. But yeah, I don't know. What do you think? Do you have a pick on this one?
Yeah, I'm going to go with the Terps for, again, all the reasons that we've liked them all season. They're just a solid team, good in all phases, and I think it's their year. I think they are going to win the whole thing, and in order for that to happen, they need to get by the Orange on Saturday.
So in the second game, like I said, I expect a 5 or 6 goal margin. I think Brown is gonna beat Navy. I think it's gonna be in that 14-8 type of range, 16-10 maybe. To me, I think that Navy will be able to rebound in a similar way to maybe an early deficit the way that they did against Yale. But they're gonna continue to push, and I think Brown will be able to continue to rack up goals unless John Connors has a remarkable day in a way that's similar to how Brown games have gone most of the season.
Yeah, and both those games will be at Brown's football stadium, Brown Stadium, a doubleheader, starting at noon on Saturday. Terry, on the other side, or on Sunday's games, North Carolina, Notre Dame, you are predicting a margin here, several goals. Who's going to win?
Yeah, so I think that we're going to see a little bit of a reversal. Maybe we're going to see something similar to the way that the Notre Dame-North Carolina regular season game went without that crazy comeback. I think Notre Dame is going to win by a score of like 15-10. I think that their offense is playing better than they were at that point. Although, to hear Kevin Corgan say it, and I think that this is right, you know, the 40 or so minutes that they played leading up to that comeback were some of the best lacrosse Notre Dame had played all season. So I think that they see the recipe, and I think that they have the focus now.
I'm going to take the Fighting Irish in that game as well, but I think it'll be a little bit closer. I think it'll be like a two-goal margin. Final game of the weekend, Terry, 2:30 on Sunday. Towson and Loyola, two Charles Street rivals. They're about 3 miles apart, the campuses. But they'll be
maybe closer.
But they'll be playing. They'll go out I-70, about 6.5 hours away to play in the Horseshoe. Who do you like in this game?
So, like I said, I think that Towson is going to punch Loyola in the face. I think Loyola is going to respond by continuing to run in transition, just continue to push. I think it's going to be a great game. I actually think it might be the best game of the weekend. And I think that Loyola is going to come away with a one or a two goal win. You know, the reason I feel that way is because it's interesting. When I was talking to a couple of Albany players after their win over UMBC, we talked about that, the difference between having Lyle Thompson on your team versus not. And they're like, Blaze is our talisman this year, and it's just different when the guy that you rely on to be, you know, kind of the source of your team is the goalie as opposed to an attackman. And I think that for Towson, they rely on Tyler White. I think now Loyola relies on Patrick Spencer, so I'm going to shade toward the team with the attackman in terms of being the one that's going to be able to make the play down the stretch late.
I like Loyola as well in this game, and I do think it'll be close as well. I think it's pretty cool, you know, as we're Baltimore guys. I used to work at Towson. You went to Loyola. That one of these teams is going to be in the Final Four. I mean, Loyola's been there recently and won a championship. It's been a while for Towson. It's pretty cool that, you know, we talk about parity, and, you know, one of our podcasts earlier in the season, we mentioned Jay Billis talking about it when the NCAA tournament basketball came out and saying, like, well, the same teams keep winning. You know, it's not like, you know, the little guys are winning championships. But we're going to see Brown or Navy make it to the Final Four, and we're going to see Towson or Loyola make it to the Final Four. So there's going to be some new guys to the party a little bit. All those programs have good, rich tradition, but haven't been to the Final Four that recently, as opposed to, you know, the ACC schools and some Big Ten schools. So I'm pretty excited about the way the Final Four is looking to shape up.
Dan, I just got a text that there's big news coming out of Charlottesville and that I have to call the administration. So I think it's time to wrap this one.
Okay.
It is very likely that by the time you listen to this podcast, the news will already be clarified and the first 15 minutes of this podcast will be rendered null. We'll have to make the decision on whether or not that we posted this. If you're listening to this, obviously we did. And maybe that's because it's just a peek inside the process and how fast moving it is. So we hope you enjoy this one. A lot going on. And Dan, you've got one more thing to say.
Yeah, a quick new words to live by. Ideas are cheap, but execution is expensive. Chris Sacca said that, Terry.
And it's a shark.
It's a little bit fitting to the things we've talked about and then what you have to do in the next 10 minutes. So, everybody, thanks for listening as always, and enjoy the games.
Go get them. Inside the Cross Podcast.